From the studios in the Communication Arts and Sciences Building on the campus of Michigan State University, this is MSU Today. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus by Russ White.
Thank you, Lynn. In a moment, I'll talk radio with Hall of Fame-bound MSU alumnus and Michigan radio leader Steve Schramm. Jennifer Orlando fills us in on the details of the 2016 MSU East Lansing One Book, One Community program. And Russ Freed on the return of Spartan Burley. MSU Today begins at 4:06 following the latest news.
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Always good to catch up with old friend Steve Schramm, who is the executive director of Michigan Radio, the public broadcasting outlet at the University of Michigan. He's an MSU alumnus. And Steve is in the 2016 class going into the Michigan Association of Broadcasters, Michigan Broadcasting Hall of Fame. Steve, congrats on that award and reflect on kind of what it means for you.
Russ, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you once again, and what a great honor. I know the words are often said and sometimes seem trite, that I am humbled and amazed to be able to be in the class of 2016. It really touched me quite a bit when I learned of that. I have loved broadcasting all of my life, all of my career. I've had the good fortune to be both in commercial broadcasting in the last 10 years, in public media here. I've been on the radio side. I've been on the commercial television side. So, and all of that experience has been here in Michigan for the most part. And boy, I'll tell you what, when I got the call, I just paused and I started reflecting on all the people that have been part of my career and all of those that were actual pivotal individuals in motivating me or pushing me sometimes to try something or to do something different. And I was thinking of my first general manager in Lansing at WVIC, MSU alum Joe Byes. I've actually asked Joe to come to the ceremony. And I was thinking of my first general manager in Detroit, Ed Christian, who was now the CEO of Saga Communications, but was a general manager at WNIC when I was but a young disc jockey, and so many others that I've had the chance to work with. It's quite a reflection to think back on your career. And my career is not over. There's still plenty of time and plenty of gas in the tank, so to speak. But I really do have a fondness and appreciation for the state of Michigan, for the broadcasters that I have worked with, for the idea and the prospect of what broadcasting means. It means so much to me to, particularly now at this point in my career with this particular station, to be able to run a successful broadcast operation that's focused on news and information and public service, because at the essence, that's what broadcasting is supposed to do. We are in the public convenience, interest, and necessity. That's what the Communications Act of 1934 suggested, that all licensees should be serving their public in that way. And I really do feel with the work that I'm doing now, that is what we do. So I haven't actually constructed my remarks for the evening of Tuesday, August 30th yet, but I will be surrounded by my family. I will be surrounded by some additional good friends that are coming that night, and certainly going to appreciate being with my colleagues. So it's a tremendous honor, and I'm very humbled and appreciative.
And Steve Schramm, as you said, in a career that's far from over, though, as you look back, how do you think radio has changed the most over those years?
Well, I mean, certainly in the more recent decade and a half, technology has played an increasing role as to how people access radio or audio content, whichever way you want to put the moniker on it. So I think that has put different pressures on the business models for both, you know, television and radio, because now it's TV anywhere, it's audio anywhere with the internet between apps and whatever else you might be able to load onto your phone or any other digital platform, you can access our content in many ways, whether you want to listen to it live as it happens on a stream, or if you want to go on demand and play back particular things like the Spartan podcast, you can do that. And congratulations to you on a great project that is multi-years of success. So we have those types of different audiences to consider and to listen to now. And because of that, we also have different ways that we have to pay attention to audience sectors. The broadcast signal has a certain composition of audience demographics. The online world is also a bit different. While it's not all skewed to a younger demographic, that is where the emerging growth is going to come from, and that is where the emerging ideas of how they want to access content are going to come from. So we have to be particularly aware of making sure we're continuing to serve our core audience, and then we also have to grow the interest from the new generation of an audience that perhaps wasn't even raised with radio in their house or in their car. Perhaps they were, but they may not have been regular users. So what we have to do, as which has been the case all along, is provide compelling content that people will want to seek out and subscribe to or become loyal to. So I think the essence of radio in terms of providing interesting content, compelling content, and also making sure that it is accessible in as many ways possible, that mission of radio is still true. Whether it's through a broadcast signal or it is through an online demand stream or whatever iterations will be coming in the future, those are the evolution pieces. But, you know, quite honestly, we evolved from AM to FM to stereo to HD, and we're still continuing to reinvent on the broadcast signal. I was reflecting on this yesterday with a very well-known international consultant who we're using here at the station. I asked her the very same question. I said, well, what do you think about the broadcast signal in the future of the business? And she said, well, there will always be those who think the broadcast signals can just be packed away and be done with. But the reality is, especially in emergencies or time of stress on communication towers such as cell towers, a broadcast signal is reliable. It's undeniable broadband that everybody can pick up at the same time. And as a result, I think that is the essence and the safety net of what will keep broadcasting alive and vital and necessary. It's almost a national safety issue.
I'm visiting with Michigan Radio's leader, Steve Schramm. And Steve, you've already started to answer it, but now sort of where is radio going and some more on some of the challenges and opportunities you see in the years ahead?
Sure. Well, I think that radio is still vital. Now there are more and more producers popping up, independent individuals who are coming up with a podcast idea, or independent individuals such as you find on YouTube or Facebook Live that have just decided to turn on their device and start coming up with content. Some of it is of the novel, viral nature. Some of it is very interesting. We are finding more creative people that are out there that perhaps would not have made the entry through a traditional broadcast channel, radio or television, but because it's as simple as pushing an app on their phone or their computer, they can now find a way to put their content out there, and it becomes an issue of discovery. And then I think one of our challenges in the future, since they can publish anywhere instantly, one of the challenges in the future is how do we attract those types of talents to come into our environment as well and to perhaps polish their craft a bit, perhaps also give them more positive notoriety. A lot of the podcasts that have grown on with national buzz in the last couple of years, particularly out of the public radio domain, actually started on public radio stations. And then the online world discovered them, and they were the darlings all of a sudden. But it was really the way that they came about, the megaphone of the public broadcasting signal. I'm thinking about Reveal and Invisibilia and other NPR offerings that started out as podcast issues, but then they became bigger than life because public radio gave them that lift. Those are the types of projects that we want to continue to be able to bring into the funnel of public media.
And Steve, you've been in both the commercial side and now in the public side. Are the differences, do you think, are they growing or have they blurred more? Is there a distinction anymore?
Well, I think, you know, the commercial side will always have a different mindset of approach. And I have many, many friends on the commercial side, and I understand the challenges and the strains that they face. I understand the fact that, you know, it is a single revenue model of advertising. And if the audience sizes continue to be splintered or diminished because of the advent of, you know, streaming music, whether it be Pandora or Spotify or name your service du jour, for those friends of mine who are in music-dominant formats, there is more challenge as to how are you going to break through, what is going to be your identity that will attract listenership. And that puts more spotlight, really, on personality, the activity of what happens between the records, between the songs, that I think will make a station identified with a particular genre. I also think that you're seeing smart things happen over, like, at Apple Music, where they're hiring basically radio program directors to cause curation of individual channels. So they're taking a lot of cues from a lot of the good best practices of radio in times past and currently, and applying those to the online world, because they knew that just a algorithm jukebox wasn't going to cut it in terms of growth of audience. So I think our commercial, my commercial radio colleagues understand those challenges. I think they still see promise for the future, just because I think they believe that they can continue to create content with the right kind of creative personnel and make things go. But by the same token, you have advertisers who are the lifeblood of how their financial model works, being splintered in more directions than ever before in terms of where they can invest their media dollars in terms of online presence. Now, we're not even talking about digital ads or what have you. We're talking about embedded content inside of podcasts, for example, and other ways that they can be involved with content makers who get paid to influence products. So there's all different business models that are out there that are taking away from perhaps what was the traditional piece of pie that broadcast advertising revenues had access to. So I think, like anything else, they have to continue to sharpen their approach. They have to be mindful of all these trends that are on the horizon and be as best possible one step ahead of those.
This is MSU Today. I'm catching up with MSU alumnus Steve Schramm, who's the executive director of Michigan Radio based in Ann Arbor. Steve, what about Michigan Radio? Tell us more about your baby and the kind of the mission and how that's evolving.
Well, we always want to, every day that we come to work, we want to be able to create what we consider the dominant news and information service for the state of Michigan, creating stories that inspire and inform and entertain about the aspects of what's important in life in Michigan, what our government is or isn't doing well, and also the ability to tell stories. I think at the core of everything, and we're hearing so much more now about storytelling. That's what you do with the Spartan podcast, Russ. And there are more storytelling events all over the country now. We happen to be affiliated with the Moth, and we do local Moth storytelling events every month here in Ann Arbor, and sometimes we spread them around the state. And then there's the big Moth Grand Slam, which is like, you know, the it ultimately becomes like the NCAA tournament of storytelling. And so it's really amazing, especially if you attend any one of these events, because the storytellers are picked out of the crowd, relatively unfiltered. And then they come on the stage, not knowing whether they will be able to tell their story that night, but they get picked. And then they do a compelling, you know, 4 or 6 minute story. And the creativity and the delivery and the enthusiasm and the drama of that is amazing. So storytelling is a core of what we do, too. But I think what we have tried to do at Michigan Radio is continue to emphasize what we can do to make sure that our local news and information content and engagement and outreach is as strong as it can be. So in the recent years, we have been able to incrementally expand our staff so that we have the resources to do that well, not only inside the building, but also making a priority of going out and doing outreach, whether it be our Issues in Ales series, which we do probably 12 to 14 times a year, whether it be outreach related to our State of Opportunity documentary series, or there's other types of outreach events when we help sponsor public radio shows that come to town, whether that be Snap Judgment or Prairie Home Companion or Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, those types of things which our audiences love, and we make sure wherever we can to bring those shows to our marketplace so that people can be personally exposed to the magic and the joy of discovery that the public radio shows have. Even when you listen to them on the radio, when you get to experience them firsthand, there's a new attachment and a new loyalty that comes out of that. So we look at all of those elements and making sure that we are continuing to take the pulse of our listeners. We've just completed a very exhaustive perceptual survey, which we're doing annually on our listenership. We're not guessing at what we think the next opportunities are. We're being very well informed with the data that we're gathering.
And what about National Public Radio, Steve, your parent? What's sort of their health and future and challenges?
Well, I think NPR is doing very well, certainly in this year, a presidential election year, with all the primaries that preceded it. NPR has been very busy. I think they have found a very good space in terms of what they are doing with not only their relationship with their member stations, which we are, but also with the relationship of how they're building more audience online with the NPR One app, which is now headed up by our former program director, Tamar Charney.
Right.
And so we're very proud of her affiliation with NPR One, and we work closely with her to make sure that our content is populated in that app. And if someone is not familiar with the NPR One app, what it does is it curates the national feed of NPR individual stories from Morning Edition or All Things Considered or from any of the other news magazine shows that they have, and they integrate it with the best of local content from the station that you particularly choose to align your app with. And so it is a Pandora of public radio. And, you know, you can do a interest or basically a thumbs up on stories that you like, and then it will look at that algorithm of what you choose, how long you listen to a particular story, and it will continue to curate stories that they figure are in the vein of what you like. So we're involved with that as well. There's just a lot of fascinating things. I think our leader, our CEO, is Jarl Mohn, and Jarl has been in the CEO chair for about 2 years plus now, and he is a dynamic leader. He has brought us back to some very smart basics on how to grow our audiences for both of our news magazines, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, basically by doing things that, from a radio instinct, make perfect sense, but perhaps all of public radio wasn't doing that, like the number of times that we run promotional announcements for Morning Edition or All Things Considered. It has been proven, even in our own case, how successful that has been, just by asking the existing audiences to listen more and come have more occasions per week when you listen. So instead of having a casual laissez-faire relationship with our listeners, we're saying, look, Morning Edition with the Michigan Radio local host Doug Tribue is an excellent program for you to consider. And here's what we're covering tomorrow, or here's what you'll hear later this afternoon on All Things Considered. Just doing some very smart basics of blocking and tackling, and that is helping grow our audience.
Are you concerned about all the competition, say, in the car? And what about the young people, the millennials? Is it a myth that they don't interact with terrestrial radio?
Well, I think what happens a lot of times, they may discover some of their favorite features online, and then they start searching, well, where can I find more of that? And, well, what do you know? It happens to be on this public radio station. And we are seeing an emerging trend of millennials that are listening to us. Perhaps the length and duration of their listening occasions are not as long as some of our core audience, but that's understandable. They're in a busy part of their life. And also, they have more dimensions of channels that they listen to, whether it be broadcast signal or online or reading editorial copy online, whatever their interest may be, they are just more diversified in the way that they access those things. So we have to continue to be mindful of the good content that we can put up online that they can discover, whether it be a podcast or an interesting story that creates, quote unquote, a driveway moment, as we used to say, or we still say, and then see where they search out for more of that information or more of that content. And that's how they come to discover us. I will say that we have a tremendous number of interns here at Michigan Radio who are all millennials because they're students, both here at the University of Michigan and many from Michigan State as well. And I will tell you, their community of friends are absolutely tuned in to what's available on public radio, and they're very passionate about it.
That's good. It's like you said, compelling content, and they'll find it. You know, as we close, Steve, for all these young people who may want to get into, let's not even call it maybe radio anymore, but sort of the communications content business, what's your advice for them?
Well, I try to make a point, Russ, of meeting with people who are interested in our business regularly. I've mentored a number of them from various universities. I keep in contact with them. And there are so many basics. It's really, what is your passion in life? Is there something that was attractive to you coming into our public radio station that you're interested in? Was it the idea of journalism? Was it the idea of creative storytelling that might be in a feature basis as opposed to a hard news basis? Was it the idea of how can I attach myself to this public service institution, this public radio station, and make contributions if I'm not necessarily a journalist or a storyteller? What other things could I do? Could it be in a marketing arena? Could it be in development? Could it be in foundation relations? All these different things that are the spokes that keep the wheel turning here at Michigan Radio. There's so many different ways that they can contribute. So when I meet with a person who I think, I have an excellent example of an MSU alum, actually. She came to visit with me. She worked at Impact, and she was a journalism major. And I said to her, she was interested in an internship, but I was so impressed with her personality. I said, well, I'm sure you could be a very successful journalist, but the sense and the vibe that I'm picking up is you are such an incredible people person and a persuasive communicator. Have you ever thought about sales and marketing? And she said, well, no, I haven't. And I said, well, there is a sales leadership course at Michigan State that I would like you to audit or sample and see if that makes a good fit for you. Well, she did that. She enrolled in that course. And throughout the course of the year, they have competitions internally with all the students that are in the program. I think there's something on the order of 70 or 80 students in this specialty program. And she won the sales competition of all of her peers at Michigan State in her first year in the program. And then she was qualified for the nationals, and she won the national sales communication leadership competition across, I think, like 36 universities across the country. And she is going to start her career in sales. And I'm so proud of her. And that woman's name is Abby Newton. And she's an absolute delight and will be a superstar. So that is one of those points of pride in being able to mentor young people and perhaps give them some direction they didn't see. And sometimes it'll lead us to broadcasting, sometimes it'll lead us to something else. But you know what, at the end of the day, as long as someone, if they've had a conversation with me or anybody else here at Michigan Radio, if they can feel inspired as to what their direction is going to be and want to pursue that, then that alone is a wonderful outcome in terms of how we have these conversations with the next generation.
Well, Steve, thanks again for sharing your insights. And again, from everyone at your alma mater, congratulations on this well-deserved award of entering the Michigan Broadcasting Hall of Fame.
Thank you, Russ. I'm proud to represent Michigan State that way, and I'm also proud to represent, you know, the good works here at Michigan Radio at the University of Michigan.
Steve Schramm is the executive director of Michigan Radio, and you can find out a lot more about Steve and the good work his colleagues do at Michigan Radio. MSUtoday.org. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
Turn it up! Turn it up! A little bit higher, radio. Turn it up! That's enough. So you know, it's got so. Radio, radio, turn it up.
WKAR. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Jennifer Orlando.
Migration and refugee issues aren't just fodder for presidential candidates. They're also at the forefront of Michigan State University and East Lansing's 2016 One Book, One Community program. The theme, Faces of Migration, the Human Experiences, features Enrique's journey by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Sonia Nazario and City of Thorns by Ben Rollins. As a refresher, One Book, One Community is a nationwide program that encourages communities to come together over a common media experience, reading the same book, watching the same video. You get the picture. Each community can determine its own themes and media selections and then choose events and activities surrounding those selections and themes. To talk about the local 2016 book selections, as well as what we can expect for this year's programming, are Kristen Shelley, director of the East Lansing Public Library, and Joelle Brown, program coordinator for the MSU East Lansing One Book, One Community program. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Migration, that is not an easy topic to unpack. There are a lot of terms and nuances associated with it. So how did you decide upon that as the theme for this year's program? And then how did you decide which books would best capture the migration experience?
Jennifer, you're so right. I mean, capturing the whole idea of immigration and refugees and migration is incredibly difficult, and the whole human experience of it. So when the One Book, One Community committee comes together. We are made up of MSU people and the City of East Lansing staff, and we come together and we meet year-round nonstop, and we discuss all kinds of topics, all kinds of books. And this year, we just thought there's so much going on with immigration and refugees specifically that this was an excellent theme. So we kind of came up with some books, and we came up with books on everything from, you know, gun violence to immigration. And we sent out books to our readers like we normally do. And overwhelmingly, the choice was Enrique's Journey. And we had been looking at Enrique's Journey in past years. Other stuff kept coming up. That was great, you know, too. So, and more timely. So this year, Enrique's Journey rose to the top, and it is truly timely, as we all know.
One Book, One Community is a way for the MSU freshman class, the incoming class, and the greater East Lansing community to come together over a common experience. So how does this process work, and why is it important to have these common experiences between the campus and city communities?
Really good question, Jennifer. But we need the entire community. We need all of Michigan. We need the entire country talking about these topics. They're important to all of us. I mean, I don't know about you, but one of my grandmothers, I know for sure, was an immigrant. And she, you know, migrated over. And I know that growing up, my mother heard only her mother and her grandmother speaking German in the house. That was it. So I think all of us can find that common theme with immigration and even with refugees. But it's really more of the human story of the journey, and the journey of nobody wants to leave their homeland. It's tragic. It's sad. They all want to go back at some point, but they leave because it's horrific, and they leave because they're trying to find, you know, their relatives here or their mothers, as in Enrique's case. His mother had left Honduras so that she could, you know, send money to the family. And so he left many, many times to try to get here to meet up with his mother. He was a young boy who was missing his mother. And it took him many, many times to get here. And it was horrific. It was horrible. You know, theft, riding on top of trains from Mexico, you know, being beaten, losing money, and then being deported time and time and time again. And this was as a young boy. So these are things that we need to talk about, of what it means, you know, the humanity of migration with people, and especially with young people. you know, people who are 18, 19, 20 years old, and then pairing them with someone from the community. And that whole conversation about the community, you know, community conversation happens when they're checking library books out, you know, at the desk, and they notice that they're reading like books, or they're in a coffee shop and they both have a copy of Enrique's Journey in their hands, or, you know, they're standing in line at the kickoff event at the Hannah Community Center. And Ben Rollins' book, City of Thorns, dovetails beautifully into that because it is about one of the largest refugee camps in Kenya. And it's almost all Somali. And there's over a million people in this refugee camp in Dadaab. And, you know, those were set up many, many years ago just to be temporary. But a million people deep, those are true cities now. They're not, those that they've made cities. And I was very, very fortunate to work with the Somali population very closely in Columbus, Ohio, when I lived there. And many of the people I worked with had lived in Dadaab. And it's not a good place to be. And so, of course, they were looking for a better place. And they were leaving a country that has no government for the most part. You know, the children that I worked with had guns in their arms before they ever saw a book. So that's the type of thing we need to talk about. It's the humanity of it.
So, Kristen, you touched upon a couple of topics that, like you said, a lot of people either experience or know someone close to them that has experienced that. And the emotions are those things that kind of remain consistent. And like you said, the humanity of it is really what brings everyone together. So some great, albeit difficult topics to talk about, but important ones. We are in the 15th year of the One Book, One Community program here in East Lansing. And how do you keep the book selections and programming fresh and exciting? Joelle?
Yeah, I think it just happens very naturally. As Kristen alluded to, the One Book, One Community Committee is made up of MSU representatives, City of East Lansing representatives, and then also community members from East Lansing. And I think the longevity of One Book, One Community, 15 years, speaks to its success, and that it knows the special stuff that makes community building happen around these stories, around these authors, around these books. Every year we just pay attention to relevant topics. We have a committee that loves to read, and so it's very engaged in what is coming up out of publishers. And Kristen is a great resource in what other libraries are using around the country and what has been successful elsewhere in the nation. And so from that, you know, kind of bank of resources, we have to think through some pretty specific things. One would be, is this book both captivating for first-year students at MSU, but also community members in East Lansing? Another is simply the author's availability, but then the author's willingness to both address 8,000 MSU first-year students at the basketball arena at the Breslin Center, but then also feel comfortable, you know, with a community question and answer moderated by the mayor. So it's an all-expansive program, and again, I think that speaks to the 15 years of it. It's such a treasure for the community, and it's really fun to plan. One Book, One Community, we come up with a theme, we throw it out there, and it's always amazing to see what kind of response we get. For example, every year we have an academic partners meeting for MSU folks who are faculty members or in administration who come together to talk about and brainstorm how to connect the One Book theme to their classrooms, to their work. And we have something similar with community members. And it's so fascinating and inspiring to be sitting around that table and to hear from a graphic design professor who can't wait for his students to read the book and create art out of the statistics or the book cover. Really just wonderful things happening in the community. There's this Immigration and Refugee Resource Collaborative that is doing work on immigration and welcoming refugees in the greater Lansing area that has been doing this for many, 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 many years. And it's fun that One Book, One Community gets to highlight their work and gets to, you know, encourage the community to think about this topic and include folks who have been doing this work already into the broader conversation.
So you touched upon it a bit, Joelle, but you're the program coordinator for One Book, One Community. You touched upon some of the events. What else can we expect this year in terms of the author's visits and some of the programming?
So as always, we'll have our kickoff event with Sonia Nazario at the Hannah Community Center. That will be Sunday, August 28th at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30, and it's usually a packed house. Doors open at 6:30, event starts at 7. There will be a portion where Sonia Nazario, the author of Enrique's Journey, will speak, and then there will be a question and answer moderated by East Lansing Mayor Mark Meadows. That will also be live streamed through the MSU alumni website as well. Then the next morning on Monday, August 29th at 9 a.m. is the MSU Academic Welcome at the Breslin Center, and that's when all of those first-year students will come, and Sonia Nazario will address them as well. That is also open to the public, and that event again starts at 9 a.m. Then later in September, on Wednesday, September 14th at 7 p.m., the East Lansing Public Library will be hosting a community event with Ben Rollins, who is the author of City of Thorns, and that will be open to the public as well and free, and he will be there to address, his book and then also question and answers as time allows. There are two other really exciting partnerships happening with One Book this year. The first is that the Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum has an exhibition right now by a British artist named Sam Jury, and that exhibition is called To Be Here. And it is a mixed video and sound installation of a refugee camp in Algeria. And so Sam Jury went to that camp and has amazing video and captured some sound. And it really kind of takes the concepts of Ben's book and shows people what it's like to actually be in a situation like a refugee camp. So that is awesome. That exhibition is up now, and it will go until November 27th. And then the artist, Sam Jury, will be in East Lansing and will be giving an education talk at the Broad in the education wing. And that will be September 13th at 7 p.m. Finally, we are very excited to be partnering with the Lansing State Journal on a storytellers event, and that will be September 20th, which is a Tuesday. And the location and further details of that are still being worked out, but the theme will be crossing borders. And so we will, take these topics of immigration, refugee issues, and just the emotional journey of finding a new home, and bring in people who have done that in the local community and really localize those conversations. And it will be an awesome event that I think will be enlightening for people who, have been participating in the entire month-long theme to see what these conversations actually look like on the ground floor in the greater Lansing area.
Well, it sounds like another wonderful year of One Book, One Community programming. Lots of great events coming up, and I'm really excited for the author's visit. So thank you both for sharing. I usually go to the kickoff event that day before the academic welcome, and it is a wonderful event. So get there early, as Joelle says. Thank you to Kristen Shelley, director of the East Lansing Library, and Joelle Brown, program coordinator for the MSU East Lansing One Book, One Community program. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for filling us in with such great information. So to learn more about the 2016 One Book, One Community program here in East Lansing, including all the events that Joelle mentioned happening here on campus and around the community, you can visit www.onebookeastlansing.com. For MSU Today, I'm Jennifer Orlando.
She's up all night to the sun. I'm up all night to get some. She's up all night for good fun. I'm up all night to get...
WKAR.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
The dramatic increase in breweries and brew pubs, not only in Michigan but across the United States, has in turn created a greater demand for barley, which when malted is a key ingredient in the brewing process. Here to talk about this surge in barley demand in general, and in particular the reemergence of a 100-year-old Spartan barley variety, is Dr. Russell Fried. Russ is a professor emeritus in the Department of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences at Michigan State, also an internationally renowned agronomist. And even though you're professor emeritus, you're staying busy, Russ.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about, back, in the 80s and 90s, did you ever think we would see this kind of resurgence in barley malting in Michigan?
No, I work very hard with a past retired extension person in Tuscola County, Bill Bortle. And they had a Stroh's malting thing in Detroit, and Bill wanted to get the Tuscola farmers to grow malting barley. And I worked very closely with him for about 5 or 6 years, but we never really got the ball rolling because we really couldn't compete with the quality of barley that was coming out of Nebraska, North Dakota, Central Canada, and stuff like that, where it's much drier. Mm-hmm. And so you got a better quality barley, because Stroh's wanted to have the same barley this year as next year as next year and next year.
Yeah, consistency for those big brewers.
Right. And the Michigan climate was something that you're going to get something different usually year from year because of the moisture and temperature and stuff like that.
So take us back 100 years to the Spartan variety of barley.
Well, that was they made a Frank Sprague, who was a researcher here at Michigan State University. In 1916, he made a cross between Michigan Black Barbless and Michigan Two Row. And it took him about 10 years or so until every generation they select the best plant and stuff like that. And so in 1928, Spartan barley was released by MSU. And it grew beyond the borders of Michigan. But it had a reign of 30 years.
Yeah.
Where it was very, very good. So Spartan had a tremendous impact on barley production around the U.S.
So Spartan went into a decline, but then fast forward to this growth in microbreweries and the need, the demand for barley for the brewing process, all of a sudden Spartan's back in the game.
Right. There was one of the maltsters was talking to, I think, one of our ag bio researchers up in Chatham, up in the UP, and said that he had heard that there, at one time, Spartan barley was a big barley grown here in Michigan, and wondered if there was any way in which he could get a hold of enough so he could malt Spartan barley. And so Ashley McFarland and Chris Kapp got in touch with me and asked me if there'd be a way in which we could get some Spartan barley to be given to our farmers. And USDA has a germplasm bank in Idaho. And I got in touch with the curator and asked him if I could have some Spartan barley. And they sent me 5 grams of Spartan, 5 grams of Spartan barley. And I planted 80 plants in a greenhouse over the winter. And we harvested those seeds. And then the next spring, up in the UP, it might be summer before the snow melts, but they planted it up at the UP. And then last winter, we sent some seed out to Arizona to be increased over the winter. And right now, there's 10 acres of Spartan barley being grown down at KBS, Kellogg Biological Station. And that hopefully is going to give us some good yield, and hopefully we'll get a lot of seed for some of the farmers next year.
I'm talking with Dr. Russell Fried, who's a professor emeritus of plant, soil, and microbial sciences at Michigan State University. We're talking about the reemergence of Spartan barley, which can be used and malted in the brewing process. So, Russ, for our listeners who may not understand, you need to raise the seed stock before you can actually get into larger commercial production. So that's right at the stage you are now.
Right. We're just increasing the seed of Spartan barley. We've gone from 5 grams to 20 bushel or something like that so far. And the 10 acres, we should get 40 to 50 bushel per acre, I hope. So we should have a couple hundred bushel.
And there are a couple of malters who are now willing to give it a shot, right?
Yeah. The whole idea of locally grown food is terribly important. But there's nothing like having Spartan barley. To have a locally grown product where you use to brew Spartan beer, there is no better feeling in the world than to imbibe Spartan barley. It's a whole new world.
Well, just think, not only in terms of the malting capabilities and advantages, but you just alluded to it, the whole marketing possibilities associated with that.
Yeah, there's no better marketer than Spartan to have the brand of Spartan barley. I mean, MSU has had a tremendous impact in Michigan and around the world in our food production system. And we're going to continue. And this is just another example of how research and extension can have a tremendous impact on the lives of the people in Michigan and around the world.
Now, down the road, I mean, I know it's hard to forecast these sorts of things, but as I understand it, this Spartan barley could all then, you're a plant breeder, could be crossbred with other types of barley that are already in use for other characteristics as well, just like any plant breeding program.
Right. They can use the genetics from Spartan barley, and so the project, you know, there'd be kids and grandkids of Spartan barley, which will still have some of the Spartan spirit that
This whole thing, and it's probably not a great analogy, but having to find germplasm in Idaho, USDA, a few grams of it. I mean, it's almost like the science that goes into forensics or crime scene investigation or something to find that.
Right. We have a great research and extension system here in the United States. I mean, the United States has one of the cheapest and safest and best food systems in the world. And USDA is just part of that, along with Michigan Ag Bio and Extension and MSU Research, as well as the other land-grant universities. Public sector is also terribly important. That makes our agriculture the strongest agriculture in the world. There is no other agriculture in the world that does what we do as well as we do it.
Well, and given the growth of the world's population, we were talking about that before we started taping this interview. I mean, we're going to need foodstuffs, and we're going to need more of it and more of it as the population of the planet expands.
Food production is going to be a big, big issue. We have hundreds of millions of people that are going out of poverty into the middle class. And when they do that, the first thing they do is they buy more food. The second thing they do is they buy better food. And so that's going to put a tremendous pressure on the food supply. And so we also have some other issues that are coming in here. In addition to the population and economic growth, we have climate change, which is putting pressure on certain areas. And we're going to have some challenging times. But I'm confident with the research and extension capabilities that we have here in the U.S. of A. that it's going to be a challenge. It's not going to be easy, but I trust we can do it.
Well, and with the emergence of the middle class that you just mentioned and people eating a little bit better, that means maybe a few extra pints of beer, and that's going to put added pressure on barley, and maybe the future of Spartan barley is virtually unlimited.
It's virtually unlimited. And like I was telling somebody else the other day, you'll never get a better feeling in your life than sitting down and taking a nice cold glass of Spartan beer. And when you finish that glass, you're going to be a different person. The whole world is going to be at your fingertips.
Well, Russ, you're making me thirsty, but keep us apprised as this unfolds. And maybe we can, once we have a malter who's actually using Spartan barley, we could have you back with that malter to talk about how it's going.
Kirk, I look forward to that. I'm very confident that that will happen.
My guest has been Dr. Russell Fried. He's Professor Emeritus of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences at Michigan State University, an internationally known plant breeder and agronomist. Russ, always good seeing you.
Always good seeing you, Kirk. Best wishes.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. Michigan State University alumna Susan Goldberg is the first woman to serve as editor-in-chief of National Geographic magazine, and she spoke to graduates at MSU's 2015 fall commencement ceremonies. She was honored to speak at her alma mater.
It's totally cool, and it's really something of a surprise because, you know, I dropped out of school for a while, and I always feel like I barely managed to graduate. So getting to come back, I did finally graduate, but getting to come back as the commencement speaker really is just a tremendous honor. I can't even tell you how much it means to me. I think MSU gave me the opportunity to succeed. You know, I had all the training I needed so that when somebody opened a door, I could walk through it and be successful. And I can never thank MSU enough for that training and for being able to take advantage of the opportunities that I've had.
Saying yes and taking smart risks are part of the message Goldberg hopes she left with the MSU grads.
I think the main one is say yes. Say yes to the things that scare you. Take bold chances. Take smart risks and understand that we are in a time of incredible change and turmoil. And that's not something to be afraid of. That's a great thing, because out of all of this turmoil comes enormous opportunities.
Susan Goldberg has been editor of National Geographic magazine since April 2014, and she's just the 10th editor of the magazine since it was published in October 1888.
Well, so I'm the editor-in-chief of the magazine. Just in the last month, I'm also the editorial director for all five magazines that National Geographic publishes. I also run our books division, and I'm in charge of all of our digital content. So it's been a very, very busy time. I've just changed jobs, expanded those responsibilities. But I've got to say, we get to handle the most fascinating content in the entire world, so it's such a privilege. But also, I've got a tremendous team. One person, can't do it. You've got to do it by building great teams who are specialists in each area and who can help us be on the cutting edge of visual storytelling, digital storytelling, textual storytelling, every kind of storytelling.
The field of journalism and its business model have changed a lot over the years.
This industry has undergone enormous change in the last 20 years. Everything about how we gather and disseminate information has changed, but also the business model that supports our journalism has been very much affected in a negative way, and it is only just now starting to get rebuilt as we figure out how to monetize our content on digital platforms. But what I really think is great is we have the opportunity now to reach larger and more diverse audiences than we ever could have reached just through print before. So we're going to meet the readers and viewers where they are, and I'm happy to give people great National Geographic content any way they want to get it, whether that's Facebook or Snapchat or in the magazine or on our website or on, streaming video.
So how do these changes impact students of journalism today?
I think people need to be flexible and keep adapting to the changes that we are midstream on those changes. No way do I think those changes are going to stop. So be smart technically, but also make sure that they're great storytellers. In the end, we can always learn new ways to adapt to the technology, but in the end, it's going to be the people with the best ideas who are going to win, who understand how to powerfully tell stories using whatever is the latest method.
Goldberg established a scholarship at MSU, and she's a member of MSU's College of Communication Arts and Sciences Alumni Board of Directors.
Well, I thought it was important to establish a scholarship because so many students now are being forced really to take internships in which they are not paid, and that's going to be the only way they can get experience. I have to say, I really don't think that's a right thing, but I can't change the world. But what I can do is help those students by, creating a scholarship that will give them stipends so they can take those internships. Otherwise, it would only be wealthy students who could get these internships where they're not paid, when in fact people, lower-income kids, middle-income kids, everybody needs to learn the craft of journalism. And I just think that needs to be something that everybody can participate in. I've gotten involved and stayed involved on the board just because I want to give back. I do feel like, as I said, that I got tremendous training. And I always have received more from MSU than I could ever get give back. So thanks. I'm just so honored to be here.
Follow MSU alumna and National Geographic Editor-in-Chief Susan Goldberg on Twitter at Susan B. Goldberg.
But we're never going to survive unless we get a little.
WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.